interview with Henry Ward Oxendine for the Southern Oral History Program series, The Long Civil Rights Movement, on Tuesday, September 23, 2003, at his home in Pembroke, North Carolina. The interviewer is Melinda Maynor. The tape number is 92303/HWO.
Bringing the noise around there, that this baby, we had anticipated that she, that they would have picked her up, and probably during the interview, her mother would come and get her. And if you want to cut that off during that period of time, that'd be okay.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
So why don't we start with when you were in high school, for example, going to an Indian-only school. What did you feel like, how would you describe that experience?
Well, you know, at that point in time, that's all we had ever known. It was sort of like being poor, you know. Everybody that I knew and everybody that I associated with was poor, and so we just thought that that was basically the only way of life that existed, and that was about all we knew. And going to school, I went to Union Chapel 8 years in elementary school, and it was all Indian, all 8 years. And then when, of course, you know, the schools consolidated in 1953, there were high schools at Union Chapel, Deep Branch, a lot of other places had high schools, but they consolidated them into four Indian high schools. And Union Chapel, Deep Branch, and Union Elementary started sending their students who were high school age, started sending them to Pembroke. And that's when we moved to Pembroke, and we joined up there with students from Pembroke Elementary, Union Elementary, Deep Branch, and it was still an all-Indian environment. And that's all we knew. There were some Indian white teachers. There were two or three teachers that we had in high school that were white, but we just never had any contact with them. And I guess up to that point in my life, nobody had ever raised the issue. We just thought that's the way it's supposed to be. The whites go to their schools, the blacks go to their schools, and we go to our schools. Mm-hmm. And really it's just something that I never thought about during that period of time in my life, because that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm. What did you think, or looking back on it, what do you think are some of the benefits and the drawbacks of that, of an Indian-only school system?
Well, I guess the obvious advantages for us was that we were around people that we knew, and we were around teachers that we knew and that knew us. And for instance, when we moved to Pembroke from Union Chapel, there was probably about 25 of us that was in the eighth grade at that point in time. And of course, when we went to Pembroke, I knew all of those students, and it wasn't long before we intermingled with the students from Pembroke and Union, and we got to feeling comfortable with each other. And of course, there was no racial tension, and well, at that point in time, we didn't even know the term. But you know, since everybody, we were all the same race, and we were all pretty much about in the same socioeconomic class. Mm-hmm. And so there was no conflicts there. It was just, you know, that would be an advantage. I guess the disadvantage, as we look back on it now, we probably, equipment that we were using, the books, we really didn't have that broad of a curriculum at the school at the time. And I guess that, as I look back on it now, probably the Indians were, and blacks were probably not receiving the same level of education that the whites were, but we weren't aware of it, and we just accepted it and moved on. Mm-hmm.
Describe a little bit for me the involvement of parents in the school, for example. Would you say that parents were more or less involved in an Indian-only school than perhaps they were after the schools were integrated? Do you see any difference there?
I don't know that I saw any difference. Of course, my reference point is my parents' involvement, and my parents, neither one of them were educated, but they did see the need for education. They wanted me to go to school. For instance, I lived within a quarter of a mile of the school, and I walked to school. And out of the 8 years that I was at Union Chapel, out of the entire 8 years of school, I probably missed 4 or 5 days out of 8 years because I went to school every day that it was important to them. And if there was any kind of a disciplinary problem at school, the schools took care of it. They didn't worry too much about what the parents were going to say because they knew the parents would be supportive of them. And for instance, if the teachers felt the need to use corporal punishment, and they used it quite a bit back in those days, they knew that the parents wouldn't be out there on them, you know, criticizing them and threatening with lawsuits and so forth. In fact, probably most students, that if they received some kind of corporal punishment at home, at school, they didn't even report it at home because they felt like they might get additional punishment. Mm-hmm. But I observed that most parents, unless there was some reason for them to get involved in their child's education, they really, there was not a lot of involvement, mm-hmm. from my observation.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's because the parents themselves perhaps were less educated, had less education than the students were receiving, or?
That's part of it. And a lot of the parents, one of the reasons I was able to go to school every day was because I didn't have to stay out and pick cotton and so forth. And we had my whole school period, especially in elementary school, it was not uncommon in the fall of the year, students would stay out until the corn was gathered, until the cotton was picked. The parents, it was just for some families, it was unheard of that the children would go to school, even when they wanted to go to school, but the parents would keep them out to pick the cotton and gather the crops. And then when all of that was done, then they would send them to school. But a lot of times they were way behind, and I think it was a factor that a lot of the parents, they felt that they had somehow made it and got along without an education, and they really, education was not that important to them, or they didn't see the necessity of doing what was necessary for their kids to succeed in school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you graduated from high school in 1957.
57.
And could you describe for me your sort of first experiences outside of here, when you kind of became aware of racial tensions in a different way, or the way those sorts of issues were handled away from here?
Well, of course, my first contact outside the Indian community was probably during the time that I was 11 and 12, and when my uncle would take us to the theater on Saturdays, and we would go, and of course we went upstairs. That's where Indians went at that point in time. It was accepted, nobody questioned it. That's where Indians went, but we had some interaction, and I can recall the all-white restaurants and black restrooms, Indian restrooms, and so forth and so on. But I was in the Boy Scouts during the time from about 14 till I finished high school. And one of the things that there was some integration back then was in Boy Scouts and other similar activities. From time to time, we would go to Capri's and other weekend trips, and we would interact with the white kids. Mm-hmm. We would have contests with them, and I never grew up really in any kind of inferiority complex, because I just wasn't in that many situations. But in the situations that we were in with those of other races, we competed, we held our own. So I felt like I could do about anything that anybody could. Mm-hmm. And when I finished high school then, it was a tradition in my family to go in the military. My mother had 8 boys, and 6 of them had been in service before me. And the brother that was older than me, he went to be examined for the service, and he had bad eyes, and he was not able to get in. But I just felt it was my duty and the continuing family tradition to go in service. And so I didn't even think about college when I finished high school. And I joined service in September of 57, 2 days after I turned 17. I couldn't get in before I was 17, but I went to San Antonio, Texas, and that's when I first had my first experiences with black people. I had never really had, other than seeing blacks at a store or something of this nature, I just had had no contact with them at all. Mm-hmm. And I saw some racial tensions down there as it relates to the whites. That was when the military was beginning to become integrated. And you could see some racial tensions and racial animosity at that point in time, but none of it was directed towards me. Mm-hmm. Because I never made it known that I was an Indian, and nobody knew that I was an Indian, so I didn't consider it, didn't even dawn on me that I should make people aware that I was an Indian. I was down there to go through basic training and so forth. So I didn't have any problems with it myself, but I was able to see some racial tensions, and one of the things I learned down there, just like in the Boy Scouts, that among the blacks there were some that were good and smart and some that weren't, and among the whites the same thing, and I was able to compete with them, and I came out of basic training feeling that I could hold my own. Mm-hmm. in any kind of situation that I was placed in.
Mm-hmm. So when you were in college then, and what made you decide to go into school teaching? Was that
it was connection? About the only thing to do at the time. Mm-hmm. You didn't even, when I was in high school, we didn't have guidance counselors. Nobody came to us and said, would you like to consider a medical profession? Would you like to consider engineering, or would you like to consider some other field? It just didn't exist. And that's why when I finished high school, I wasn't even college oriented. I knew I went into service, but it was during the time that I was in college when I made up my mind that I was going, or the time I was in service, I made up my mind I was going to college as soon as I got out of service, and I did. I got out of service like on the 20th of August, and I was enrolled in college within a week. And at that point in time, I still didn't think of in terms of doing anything but teaching, because that's basically what Indian college graduates did during that period of time. If I had had somebody, for instance, when I was in the military, I was a medical service technician. I worked around hospitals, emergency rooms, and on the wards and stuff like that. And we had a male nurse who was a first lieutenant, and I thought that was really great. That's something I'd never seen a male nurse. And I said, I could do that. It didn't even dawn on me that, well, why not try to be a doctor or something like that? That was just something we didn't even, Indians, for the most part, during that period of time, did not think in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Why not, do you think?
Well, we didn't have any examples. There weren't, Dr. Martin Brooks was the first Indian doctor that I ever recall, and he came back to Pembroke, I believe, in 1958. Of course, I was in service at the time, and he had, of course, he got his education in Michigan. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have any examples, and we had lots of examples of school teachers and farmers. Mm-hmm. So that's basically, that was the extent of my thinking during college, that I would be a school teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you got out, you started teaching school. Tell me a little bit about that experience, getting a job,
well,
and, you know, where you taught and things
like
that.
Okay, I majored in history, and my minor was in social studies, and so I had wanted to teach at the high school level, and I made contacts with, but you know, one of the strange things, I never did go to the Board of Education and fill out a application. I knew that if I was going to work, it would be at an Indian school. And there were only four Indian high schools at the time. It was unheard of during that period of time for an Indian to teach in a white school, or a black school, or blacks teach in an Indian or a white school. So,
and this is 1964.
64. Right. There weren't, to my knowledge, there were no interracial teachers that I knew of. Now there may have been that I didn't know, but I made contact. I knew Mr. Bartow Clark out of Union Chapel, and he told me that he would give me a job. He wanted me to work there, but that was eighth grade. And I made contact. I tried to get a job at the high school level, but that didn't work out. So I went to Chapel. That was my first work experience as a teacher in eighth grade. all Indian kids, mm-hmm. all Indian faculty, all Indian staff. We had absolutely no contact with any white whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Let me take that back now. There may have been, during the about the third year that I was there, it seemed like there was a lady that came to the county. Her husband was a professor at the university, and she got a job in the county. She may have worked out there for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Okay. There might have been a couple of teachers that were associated with the people that worked at the university. But for the most part, it was all Indian.
Mm-hmm. Thinking back on 1964, do you remember any awareness of the struggles that African Americans were having in the South to kind of break apart school segregation or voting or any of those issues that they were involved with?
Well, there was some. There was some. People like Dr. Brooks and some others that I could, Tommy Dial and maybe Mr. Harper Moore and some others like that were. They were beginning to get a little active, politically active. I remember Dr. Brooks, he ran for the Board of Education. At that point in time, of course, double voting existed, and he ran a good campaign, he ran hard, but there was not enough Indian voters to put him in office. But people like him, they were beginning to get active in some things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, how do you think this freedom of choice, explain for the microphone, what the freedom of choice system was and tell us a little bit about how you feel like it came about, your sense of that.
Well, of course, after the Brown versus the Board of Education decision, when the Supreme Court basically outlawed segregated schools. That was in 54, I believe. Mm-hmm. I believe it was along that time. Well, there was still some foot dragging, and for the next 7 or 8 years, or maybe almost 10 years, there was really nothing that changed in Robeson County. And that's when the Indians didn't push it, the blacks didn't push it. But starting probably in the early 60s, there was some effort made on the part of some parents in Lumberton, and the dates that I'm going to give you, I'm not exactly sure about these, but they're approximates.
Yeah.
But I remember being in college, and there was some activity on the part of some Indian parents in Lumberton that they said, we're tired of our children having to get up early in the morning and get on a bus and go to Fairgrove School. That's where Indians basically, if they lived in the south side of Lumberton, they went to Fairgrove. If they lived in the north side of Lumberton, they went to Magnolia. Mm-hmm. And they said, we shouldn't have to do this. We should be able to send our kids to the high schools here locally. And I think there was some activity in that part, and Lumberton did start admitting Indian students. Because at that point in time, there was about 6 different districts in the county, school districts. Maxton, St. Paul's, Red Springs, Fairmont, Lumberton. All of these had their own school systems. And they all had white, for instance, in the town of Lumberton, there was a white high school, there was a black high school. There were white elementary schools and black elementary schools. But there were no Indian schools at that period of time. And I think in Lumberton, there may have been an elementary school over in West Lumberton. I think that existed during that period of time. But the Indian kids, for the most part, even in Red Springs, St. Paul, all of these towns, the Indian kids came out of the town districts into the county schools. But nobody complained about it. That's just the way it was. That's the way that it was set up, and it had been going on like that for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. But I do remember in early 60s, some Indian parents in Lumberton started making some noises, and Lumberton started admitting Indians to their own school system, down there to high school in particular. I believe there was an elementary school for Indians in Lumberton, but there wasn't any high school. Mm-hmm. So that started early 60s. And I'm not sure the exact years. I remember when I was teaching school, they came up with something. One of the solutions was, well, instead of forcing parents to send their kids to the nearest school to them, or we're going to have freedom of choice, and we're going to give parents the opportunity to send their kids to whatever school they want to. That was, in my opinion, that was an effort to avoid doing what should have been done. In my opinion, what should have happened, they had school district lines, even back in the 40s and 50s. For instance, there were Indians that lived on one side of a particular road, might have send their kids to Union Chapel, and if they lived on the other side, they might go to Piney Grove. So there were district lines, but what they should have done when they started desegregating and trying to integrate the schools is said, well, if you live within the Piney Grove Elementary School District, then regardless of your race, you go to Piney Grove. But that would have been unacceptable, and it would have created a lot of problems, because during that period of time, whites did not want to go to Indian schools. Indians didn't want to go to black schools. And so they came up with this thing called freedom of choice. It sounds good, but it was an effort to get around closing district lines. And the way that it worked, for instance, I have family members that lived right here across the road in Stanley Heights, and they wanted to go to Red Springs High School. In fact, within my own family, I had two sisters-in-laws. One of them wanted to go to Red Springs High School. The other one wanted to go to Pembroke. Mm-hmm. So they'd come out every morning and stand at the road, and the bus that was going to Red Springs would come by and pick up one of the girls. The bus going to Pembroke would come by and pick up the other. At Union Chapel, there was a family that lived within hollering distance of the school. And they had been sending their children to Union Chapel all the years, but once they started Freedom of Choice, they decided, well, I believe we want our kids to go to Philadelphia's. Mm-hmm. And so they would, the bus would come by, sometimes we'd be at, maybe in the afternoons we'd be out on the playground doing something, and the bus would come by and drop these kids off. But that's the way Freedom of Choice was, that you could go to other schools. Now, you couldn't go, for instance, if you lived at Union Chapel and you wanted to go to Littlefield, you couldn't do that, but you could go to schools that were close by your home, other schools.
Okay.
That existed, I don't know, probably to 1970s, or into the 70s, and I'm not sure when it ended.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that was basically the rule, as it were, while you were teaching it at Union Chapel.
Right. Yeah.
And did you experience much of that in your own classroom?
No. No, it didn't happen a lot. There weren't that many Indian families that wanted their kids. The example I cited you of these children living near to the school that wanted to go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia, up to that point in time, well, it was an all-white school. And I think they just wanted to go there because they could. Mm-hmm. There was nothing superior about their teaching. In fact, it was a very small elementary school. It probably had less than about six or seven teachers. And in my opinion, the level of instruction was not as great there as it was at Union Chapel. Mm-hmm. And most of these parents, as a matter of fact, most of these parents, they did it a year and they changed back. Mm. Yeah. But I know some others that went to Red Springs that lived right here near where we're sitting, and they wanted to go to Red Springs, and they went there the whole year and graduated. I know one individual in particular that went to Red Springs and graduated from Red Springs High School. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of my uncle, Michael, and some of his younger brothers and sisters, I believe, went to Red Springs.
Yeah.
Graduated from there, and my sister Cherry went to Red Springs too.
Yeah, that was a part of it, and they
in the same time period.
Yeah.
Well, looking back on it, then, what do you feel like? Well, maybe we should talk about your decision to go to law school, because it seems like there's some things kind of happening there at the same time. You know, people are maybe getting dissatisfied with the freedom of choice option.
Well, there was some movement during that period of time to end that and to try to equalize the schools. And of course, there was the rumblings about double voting had started, and that became a really big issue during that period of time. But I taught school 4 years at Union Chapel, eighth grade, and then in 1968, I had been teaching 4 years. We had basically elementary schools and a high school. So they decided they would establish a junior high school. They built a new high school over on the Deep Branch Road. And then what had been the high school became the junior high school. Mm-hmm. And that was, the junior high school consisted of seventh graders and eighth graders. So what they did, consisted of eighth graders and ninth graders. Okay, so all of the eighth grade students that had been going to chapel and these other places moved to Pembroke, mm-hmm. and I moved along with that. So I worked at Pembroke at the junior high school mm-hmm. For 2 years.
Okay.
And during that period of time. And I think during that 2 years, we had a couple of white students. I don't recall any black students at all during that period of time, but even in Pembroke at that period of time. We had some white faculty members. And everybody got along good, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I was in the JCs during that period of time, and this was another opportunity that we had. I think JCs was established in Robeson County, maybe Pembroke in the early 60s, maybe 65 or so, but I became a member, and we interacted with other JC clubs throughout the state, and here again, it just, you know, I've never had a self-esteem problem. My interaction with white folks, I looked at them like I did everybody else. I said some of them were dumb, some of them were smart, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I interacted with them and got along well. But I had a friend, Horace Locklear. Horace went to law school in 1979. And he went to North Carolina Central in Durham, and I knew he was going there, but it never had crossed my mind to go to law school. But at a JC meeting in Raleigh, I believe it was, I was talking to Horace, and I was asking him what he was doing, and he told me what he was doing, and I said, well, you know, I might like to try that. He said, well, you need to apply. And I said, I believe I will. So when I got back home, I think he got me an application. I filled out the application, and I sent it off on like a Monday, and I got a letter back on Wednesday telling me, you are in law school. I had not taken any kind of test. I had done nothing. I just got a letter back saying, you have been accepted to law school. And this was probably about January of 1970. And I talked it over with my wife and some other family members and Mr. Newman, who was principal at the junior high at the time. And I was satisfied as a teacher. I felt like I was doing a good job as a teacher, and I was satisfied as a teacher. But this was just an opportunity for me. And I had been in the service, and I had not used my GI Bill. I had that available for me, and there was a scholarship available for Indian law students at that period of time. So I said, well, I believe I'll go for it. And I started making my preparations to go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And I resigned from teaching. I had been teaching 6 years, and that's when I went to law school in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you find when you got there? Was it different? You know?
Well, it was different. Of course, I was more mature. I was 30 years old when I started law school, and having been in service, and I knew it was going to be competitive, and I knew what I would have to do it, and so I just buckled down. The same year I started, Earl Knox Chavis and Arnold Locklear started law school. And as circumstances would have it, I really don't know how it turned out that way, but we rented a duplex on Green Street in Durham, and Earl Knox and Arnold lived on one side of it, and I lived on one side of it with Sandra and my two boys. So Earl Knox and Arnold and myself, we rode the classes together, and we spent a lot of time socializing, just visiting with each other, and that was probably a good experience, because we could talk and about how things were going and support each other in our efforts there. Mm-hmm. Harsh was 1 year ahead of all of us. We went to law school. I went to law school 2 years. He was there the first 2 years I was there. He graduated in 72, and he moved on. And of course, Arnold and myself and Knox graduated in 73. There was another Indian student from down here named Betty Jo Hunt. Betty Jo had graduated from Pembroke College in 70. She's a very smart girl, and she went to Duke University, and she graduated law school in 73 also. So there was four of us that graduated that year.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to school with African-American students, right?
Just the three of us.
Yeah.
Well, when Harsh was there, there was four of us, okay. Four Indians going to North Carolina Central.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly a black student body. There was probably 20% of the class may have been white. Yeah, that's the way that happened.
Okay.
And I don't recall, during the time we were there, I don't think any more Indians enrolled during the 3 years that I was there. I know after I left the first year, some others did, but mm-hmm. there's been a lot of Indians that graduated from North Carolina Central.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting, you know, you all kind of found each other and established
yeah.
your
Well, I knew Knox was going to law school, but I didn't, just us moving together there. In fact, I may have, Harsh may have told me about where they were living and that there was an apartment available next door to them, and I checked on it, but yeah, that's the way it turned out, that we spent a lot of time together.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was happening here in Robeson County when you were in law school in terms of these issues that we've been talking about, school
Well, the big issue, of course, was double voting.
Right, you'll need to explain that to
yeah,
us.
And that had gone on forever. I mentioned that we had these other school systems. Lumberton had its own school system, St. Paul's, Red Springs, Maxton, and Fairmont. And then, of course, there was the Robeson County schools. And each one of these school systems had a board of education that was elected by the people. For instance, Lumberton had a board of education that consisted of about six or seven members. The Robeson County School Board consisted of approximately seven or eight members. The voting, what was happening in the county at that time, everybody that lived in the county, even including the people that lived in these cities, were voting on the Robeson County Board of Education members. Even though the Robeson County Board of Education had no jurisdiction over these city schools, they were separate entities, but still the citizens of these towns were voting on the Robeson County Board of Education. But the citizens that lived in the county, such as myself and Pembroke didn't have a separate school system. But people such as myself and all of the people that lived out in the county, we had absolutely no authority or any kind of vote over what went on in the city school system. And it was referred to as double voting because, for instance, the citizens in Lumberton, and there were thousands of them, they voted on their Board of Education and they voted on the County Board of Education. And as a result of that process that had been going on for years and years, even though the majority of the students that went to the county school system were Indians, the majority of the Board of Education was not Indians. In fact, there was only one member of the Board of Education that was an Indian, for the most part, that I can remember during that period of time. And there might have been one black. And the reason for that was that these city school districts and the people that lived in these cities, they controlled the Robeson County Board of Education. And I mentioned Dr. Brooks ran for the Board of Education, and Indians were overwhelming in their support of him. he ran very well in all of the Indian precincts, but when it would come to the white precincts, particularly in these towns, they just did not vote for him. And of course, he did not win. And what it was, you had a Board of Education that was really not elected by the parents or the citizens that they were supposed to serve.
And, you remember what year it was that Dr. Brooks ran?
It was probably 66 or 68, 19, one of those years. I'm not sure exactly which one. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he ran a good campaign, and but he just, you know, he couldn't win. Whites didn't vote for Indians at that period of time. Mm-hmm. And it was a very frustrating thing to the citizens of the county that we're having people that don't even have anything to do with this Board of Education, or shouldn't have anything to do with it, but they're calling the shots and they're electing the people that's going to be on the Board of Education.
Mm-hmm. And let me just back up one second to ask whether the boards of education for all of these different districts controlled the schools of all races. So the county board would control white, black, and Indian schools
in the county. The county schools.
Okay, even though there were no, or maybe one, or you know, one Indian and one black representative on that board.
Right, that they controlled. They made the decisions that affected the Robertson County schools. The Robertson County schools. And that's why I mentioned there were four Indian high schools in the county at that point in time.
Okay.
Magnolia, which Indians from the northern part of the county went to Magnolia. Prospect, Indians from the sort of the northwest, that area, went to Prospect High School. Then there was Pembroke, and then there was Fairgrove. Mm-hmm. If you were an Indian in Robertson County in 1960, you went to one of those Indian schools, regardless of where you lived.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was a very unfair system. It was very frustrating. The people at the main office were not really responsive to the needs of Indian people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In my opinion.
So when do you feel like, or can you pinpoint a time? Maybe you can. That's okay. That it sort of, that consciousness took off.
It was started in about the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, of course, that's when, Martin Luther King, when he became active in the 60s, there was some activity here on the part of Indians. When blacks started becoming politically active, we sort of followed behind, and this is my assessment of it. And I remember some Indians would go to meetings that blacks would hold, and when they would bring in speakers, national speakers, and so forth, and that's when it started, probably in the mid '60s, and it just kept snowballing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, then take us to the events that led up to your appointment to the state legislature. You're in law school, right?
I'm in law school, and of course I have been involved in as much as I could in political activity out at in my precinct. I was a Democrat, and each precinct had its own chairman of the Democratic precinct out there, and I was chairman at Union Chapel, and I remember the election of 1970 for judges and the sheriff and so forth. We were hauling voters and so forth and trying to make some changes, but it was almost an exercise in futility, to tell you the truth. But although I would say this, the Indians were instrumental in electing Ben Floyd, the clerk of the court. That's the first time that I can recall Indians playing a major part in electing somebody. I think it was 1962. Ben Floyd ran for clerk of the court, and I don't even know who he ran against. I didn't know Ben Floyd at that time, but he came out into the Indian communities, and he said, basically, his message to us was, if you all will help elect me, I'll put an Indian in the clerk of the court's office. There hadn't been no Indians employed in the clerk of the court's office up at that point in time, and no blacks. And with the help of Indian voters, he won. He ran against another white man out of Lumberton. And of course, most of the whites in the county did not support Ben Floyd. A lot of them did. But he was able to get most of the Indian vote, and I think a lot of the black vote, because he told them he would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first time I remember Indians uniting for a common cause. I'm sure there may have been other times, but that's the first time I remember. But I had been active in my precinct, and even when I was in law school and so forth, I was still active, and because I felt at that point in time the way to bring change about changes was through the political process. And the Democratic Party, within the structure of the Democratic Party, you've got the chairman, vice chairman, and so forth, but you also have various committees whose job it is to make recommendations in the event that there become vacancies in offices. For instance, if there had become a vacancy in the state senate at any point in time, there was a committee within the Democratic Party that was to make recommendations to this on the state level to fill that position. Well, as it just happened, when the Democratic Convention was held in 1972, the House of Representatives committee, the appointees to that was Brenda Brooks and a black lady, and I can't recall her name at the present time, but they were appointed to that position. Of course, nobody really thought they'd do anything. There had never been a situation in my lifetime where they ever had to make any recommendations. But they were appointed to that committee. And so in 1973, about March, Representative Frank White, who had been elected during the election of 1972, he was in Raleigh. He started his term in the General Assembly. He had cancer, and he died, I think, sometime in March. Well, that's when that committee that was comprised of Brenda Brooks and the black lady, and of course Robson was in a district with Hope County and Scotland County, and each of these other counties also had a similar committee. Mm-hmm. And all of these people met. And Robinson County had the most votes because they had the most votes on that committee because they had more voters that voted in the election. And so really it was Brenda's call and this black lady, whoever they suggested would be the person that would get appointed to the House of Representatives. And Herman Dahl was instrumental in recommending to them that I get the appointment. And so my name was submitted to the State Board of Elections and through the political processes, and that's how I got appointed. Mm-hmm. I didn't win that election, I got appointed to it.
Now, who was Mr. Herman Dahl?
Herman Dahl was a county commissioner. He was very active, and he's from Prospect. His father was, I can't think of his name, but his mother was a Moore, very politically connected. It's Adolph's brother, you know Adolph Dahl.
Yeah, sure.
Adolph's brother. Okay. And Herman was a county commissioner during that period of time.
Okay.
So he recommended that Brenda and this other lady recommend me, and they did, and of course I got the appointment in 73. I was in law school at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of caught me by surprise. But anyway, that's how I got appointed to the House.
Okay. What did you feel like you had a mission or a mandate or a charge to complete something? What was your...
Well, I didn't... I felt very strongly about equality of opportunity for everybody. But as far as me having an Indian agenda, I didn't have an Indian agenda. I had an agenda for poor people, disadvantaged people, the lack of medical care, and things of that nature that affected poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that affected a whole lot of Indian folk, you know, because most of us were in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, throughout the times that I've been in public office, I've never felt that there needed to be any special treatment, that if everybody was treated the same, you know, that would solve the problem. That was my philosophy, and I felt that government should be fair to everybody.
Mm-hmm. What do you think made Mr. Herman Dahl recommend you?
Well, he knew me personally, and he knew some of my other family members. Mm-hmm. And I was in law school at the time, and he knew I was active and involved in some politics and some political issues. Even though I was in law school, I came to Robeson County. I stayed in law school 3 years, and I came down here probably at least 2 weekends a month, and I spent a lot of time in Robeson County. Mm-hmm. I never did sunk my feet in Durham. Even though I was up there 3 years in law school, I was still a Robeson County boy. In fact, I always had an address in Robeson County. I always voted in Robeson County. I never changed any of that when I went up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the reason I asked about Mr. Herman was because we didn't really talk about Indians that were part of the county commissioner's board. Mm-hmm. And other than him, were there others who had been elected to that position?
Bobby Dean Locklear was elected in, I want to say, 1972. I think that's when Bobby Dean got elected. And he beat out the guy from Red Springs. But one of the reasons Bobby was able to do that, that district was comprised of a lot of Indian folks. It was Burnt Swamp into Philadelphia and some other precincts. And then Bobby was able to get quite a bit of black support, and he won that election. And I want to say it was 72. I'm almost positive it was. Mm-hmm. So Bobby Dean and Herman were the county commissioners Indian at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure there was a black member. I don't think there was a black. There may have been, but I'm not sure.
Had there been a county commissioner before Mr. Herman?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a... I can't think of Mr. Sampson's name, but he was from the Deep Branch area, I think, and he was the commissioner. See, the county was divided into districts, and this district, what I would call the Pembroke Prospect Union District,
okay. Well, then let's go back then to double voting. So you're in the state legislature, and trace out for us the sort of events that led up to breaking double voting down.
Well,
how it looked from your perspective.
Of course, even before I went to the General Assembly, you know, we had approached the senators, Senator Britt and others, and asked them to, you know, try to appeal to them that this is wrong. You can end it by legislation. You can introduce a bill. It had been done by legislation, and it could be undone by legislation. But the prevailing attitude at that point in time among the people, particularly in Lumberton and these other towns, and the white voters in the county did not want double voting to end, because they did not have enough of votes on their own to elect a majority of the Board of Education for the county only. You need to understand, and at that period of time, Indians lived in the county. There were very few Indians that lived in the towns. Blacks lived in town. Black voting in the county board was very small. It really didn't hardly make a lot of difference. And so the white voters in the county did not want double voting to end. So they basically told the politicians, you're not going to do it. So, you know, we don't want you to end double voting. So really you had Indians lobbying the legislator for it, and whites lobbying against it. And if it had been a legislative thing, it probably would never have changed. But it was changed by the courts. Mm-hmm. Some individuals took the cases to court. And that's when the ball got rolling. The district court overturned double voting, and they
that would be a federal court.
The federal district court overturned it, and I want to say it was in 74, maybe somewhere along there, and then it was appealed to the Court of Appeals, and they upheld that decision. So in effect, the courts did what the Indians had been asking the legislature to do for all of this period of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you remember who the individuals were that that pushed it through the court system?
Well, I remember Brian Nickell may have been the lead lawyer for the county at that period of time. Dexter was in, Dexter Brooks, he started law school in 73. I graduated in 73. He started the year we graduated. And Dexter had been very active in politics of various kinds. And I think Brian Nickell was the lead attorney, I think he was, and even though Dexter was only a freshman in college, he worked with him on it and probably did a lot of research and so forth. And I think that that was pretty much the lawyers that handled it did that. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it was a shock to the residents of the county, as you can very well imagine. The Indians were happy, you know, it was a glorious day for us when it was announced, but there was a lot of upset white folks in the county about it. And because there had been an election, I want to say in 74, there had been an election under the old system of, and here again, I'm not sure about all of the everything that was involved in it, but when the courts overturned double voting, you had this Board of Education in place that had been elected as a result of the double voting process. Well, what the lawyers, Brian Nickell and others, they wanted the courts at that point in time to declare that the Board of Education that was sitting was illegally elected and just and declare a call for a new election. Mm-hmm. Well, there were others of us that felt, well, it's really not necessary to do that now. The next election will take care of the problem, and it would be very disruptive to remove this Board of Education and hold a special election to declare to get a new board. And I was one of them that felt that way. I was in the legislature at the time. I know I got a lot of criticism for that decision because the blacks, that was their position, at least that was Joy Johnson's position. He was in the House too. He felt that way, that let's go ahead and just let these members of this board stay in position. And when the election occurs in 1976, it'll take care of the problem. I believe there had been some effort made in to modify the system or add some additional Indians to the board before double voting was declared illegal. I think there was a couple of Indians that had been added. That was sort of a compromise of sorts. And so I think at the actual time that double voting was declared illegal, there was like three Indians on the board and two blacks, I believe, that had been put there by the legislature. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us felt, well, there is some Indian representation on the board, there's some black representation. And in 1976, these cities will not be allowed to vote in the election anymore, and let's just wait and let that take place.
Okay.
But there was a group that was rebel rousing to, I shouldn't use that term, but they were activists for let's have this board thrown off and have a whole new election next week.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't happen.
So now, were you involved in the decision to add those Indian and black board members?
Yes, I was.
Describe that for us, whose idea that was and how that came about.
Well, now here again, that's been 30 something years ago, but I think there was a bill that was drafted. Senator Britt led the effort to expand the Board of Education
for the county,
mm-hmm. The county board, to expand it. I'm thinking it was like seven members, and this may have expanded it to 10 or 11, and those new members would be Indians and blacks. And at that point in time, I think I'm right on this, the Board of Education for the county, there were no districts. You just ran for the board and everybody in the county voted, and the highest vote getters were the ones that won. There were no districts. And that's one of the reasons that Indians were not able to, because everybody in the county was voting, one of the reasons there was county commissioners from Indian county commissioners is because there was county commissioner districts. And so Herman Dahl and Mr. Sampson that I mentioned, they were elected because they lived in an Indian district. But on the board, there were no districts. And so this legislation that was passed was sort of something to, this was before double voting was declared illegal. It was an effort to try to get more Indian representation on the board.
Mm-hmm. So those particular seats on the board had to be reserved for Indians?
I think the legislation that was passed named who the individuals would be.
I see. Okay.
I think it named two Indians, or maybe three Indians and two blacks, I'm not sure, but it increased the minority representation on the board.
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter resistance to that plan in the
general assembly? No, it was generally supported. Keeping in mind now, double voting had not been ruled on, and there was pretty good support for that here in the camp. In fact, that was as a result of all the activities that had taken place, and Senator Britt probably felt a lot of heat, and that was sort of his compromise to, well, we're not going to overturn double voting. I'm not going to introduce legislation to eliminate that, but we will change and add more seats to the Board of Education. In other words, he was willing to allow for more Indians to be on the board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that works in sort of a tradition of Indian education period. Back in the 1880s, the State General Assembly named the trustees for the Croatan Normal School, and that was under control of that body too. So it's kind of a different way to get Indian education.
These members, that this legislation was passed during session, and it was after the election had taken place, and it named the individuals that would serve in those positions. But now they had to stand for an election the next time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think before they got a chance to run, double voting was outlawed by the courts.
Mm-hmm, I see. Did you encounter resistance to that plan to add board members here at home?
No, most people were in support of that.
Yeah.
They felt like that was something. I mean, it wasn't. We still wanted double voting eliminated, but in the interim, that was at least some progress. Mm-hmm. That would get more Indians on the board and more blacks.
Mm-hmm. Did the federal government in this time period, did they get involved in these events in Robeson County?
I don't recall that they did. And here again now, this is an area that I don't know a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Voting Rights Act of 1965, I think I'm right on this. It specified that any time there was a change in the voting process in certain southern states, approval had to be obtained from the Department of Justice. Now, to what extent that played into this, I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
But they would have approved of this bill that added new members, because basically what the Department of Justice was concerned about was any kind of changes that would diminish minority representation. And of course, this, when Senator Britt introduced this legislation, that increased minority representation.
Right, right. Do you remember how those particular individuals were chosen for those board positions?
No, I don't, because most of that had been done when I got up there.
By the time you got up there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
It was a political process. I'm sure that some of the political people here in the county had met with the senator, and some of the people that had run for it before was active in it. And
right.
Yeah.
Okay. What would you, looking back on it, what would you say was really the impact of breaking double voting?
Well, it allowed the school board to be more responsive to Indian needs, because basically 1976 was the first year that there had been a vote under the new ruling, where the cities could not vote in the County Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the exact figures, but after that election was over, there were more Indians voted on the board than any other race. And then I want to say it was something like 5-4-3 or something like that with the but the Indians were in control of that board. And one of the things that existed under double voting, the people that worked in the main office at the Board of Education, a lot of them lived in the city of Lumberton. A lot of them were family members of politicians in Lumberton, and they lived in the city of Lumberton, but they sent their kids to the Lumberton City Schools, and they really, their heart was not in, at least from my perspective, their heart was not in working for the board. It was just a job. And after double voting was ended and the Indians took control of the board, Mr. Allen was the superintendent, and I forgot who was the assistant at that point in time, but Mr. Allen resigned in a few years, and I think that's when Mr. Purnell Swift took over as the superintendent. So it was within about 3 years that before double voting was ended, if you walked in the board, you might see an Indian sitting over here. They had some Indian supervisors that basically their job was to supervise teachers in the Indian schools only. But after double voting ended, you had Indians in the top job. Assistant superintendents were Indians. Just Indians were more participants in the process. Mm-hmm. And the board was more responsive to the Indians in the county.
Yeah. Now, what about the actual process of integration, getting students of different races going to the same schools? How was that sort of progressing at this time?
Well, they had by then they had pretty much set up school boundary lines, and you had to you went to the school that was in your district. Mm-hmm. And that brought about some integration, but society is integrated. For instance, there's a school in Lumberton that I can think about right now, and everybody that lives within that would attend that school is 90% white. Well, now you can talk all you want to about integration, and if they say, well, we're going to let everybody that lives near this school come to this school, well, it's still going to be 90% white because your communities. For instance, if you take over in South Lumberton, most of the people over there are black. Mm-hmm. And so the schools over there are going to be black. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you can do about that situation. I know they tried busing in Charlotte and all that kind of stuff, but I'm not sure that that's the solution. But in Robeson County, by this time, this freedom of choice had ended. And so basically, people were having to send their kids to the nearest school. And one of the things you had happening at that point in time, there was a lot of movement to annex in and around Lumberton. There were a lot of, before double voting ended, and the way schools were, say, in the 50s, like I say, if you were white or black, and you lived on the edges of Lumberton or around the town, you sent your kids into the city schools. No, there was no problems and there was no questions asked about it. Because Lumberton, for instance, in 1960, there was a white high school and there was a black high school. If you lived around Lumberton, you sent your kids to the white high school. If you were white and if you were black, you went to the black high school. Well, now, when they started closing district lines, a lot of these parents that were living on the outside of the city limits, they started asking to be annexed into town. So during that period of time, Lumberton did a lot of annexing. And it was basically to get people in that had built in these developments around the town. They didn't want to send their kids to the county schools. Mm-hmm. For instance, there in North Lumberton, those kids, some of them were having to send their kids, or would have had to send their kids to Piney Grove. They said, well, we're not going to have this. And so they had themselves annexed into the town. Then they could be a part of the Lumberton City school system.
Right. Okay. So that was like another way of delaying.
Right. Of getting around it. Yeah. Of getting around it.
Mm-hmm. How long do you feel like those tactics continued to work?
Oh, Well, probably up until the schools merged in 88. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that brought about the school merger. The federal government was starting to look at a lot of these annexations and all of these things, and they were starting to tighten down, and one of the individuals that was instrumental in that was Eric Prevatt. You might want to talk to him, but he lived in the Clyburn Pines section, and his kids went to Piney Grove. And he instead of, you know, I have a lot of respect for him, but he didn't, I don't know, but he started a movement, and he was involved in it probably for 6 or 7 years. The movement to merge the schools didn't just happen in 88. A lot of people tried to get it done by legislation, but the representatives and the senator, particularly the senator at the time, and said there's just no way I'm going to vote for that because the people of this county, at least the ones that vote for me, don't want it. And so it never would have been done through legislation. But Eric Prevatt, I would say, he was responsible more than any other person that I can think of for bringing this matter to the front. He convinced a lot of white people in the county that merger is in your interest. Because if these school systems don't merge, you know, we're not going to have the kind of school system we want. So the vote took place in 88 to merge the schools. It was not supposed to pass. Nobody predicted, well, a lot of people predicted it would not pass. But there was more whites voting for it than people realized. Mm. And giving credit, you know, where credit's due, there's a lot of people that lived in the towns. They voted for it, even though it would affect them probably adversely, some of them, but they did it because they thought it was the right thing to do. The whites in the county that voted for merger, basically, they wanted to see one school system because then they felt that the overall quality of the schools would improve. And it probably has. Mm-hmm. There was a general feeling that the cities sort of, now, they did tax themselves, for instance. Lumberton had a special school tax, so people in the city of Lumberton did pay special tax for their schools. And they had a good system. And I got the impression that most of the people that lived in Lumberton said, well, we've got a good school system, and we're going to take care of our kids. You folks out there in the county, you do the best you can. But after school merger passed, and there came the realization that we're all in the same boat now, and we need as good a school system as we can get because it affects all of us pretty much equally. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting that it took such a long time.
Yeah.
You have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, these movements, it was probably up until, Martin Luther King? Just like I mentioned to you, you know, about when I was going to public schools, I knew no other way. I thought that was the way. You know, I thought it was God's order that we were supposed to be separated. You know, and nobody could really question it. But then, you know, after Martin Luther King started raising some issues, and we started looking at it in another way, and started realizing that, you know, we've been getting the short end of the stick. Like equipment at the schools. I taught school at Chapel for 4 years, and sometimes we'd get new books. Most of the times when we got books, they were books that hadn't been used 2 or 3 years. They'd use them somewhere else and ship them to us. Indians and blacks were getting the short end of the stick. And it just, you know, these kinds of movements, and at least my observation, just, they take a while, they don't happen overnight, but they happen, and mm-hmm. we're where we're at now.
Mm-hmm. Did you think the American Indian movement here in the 70s and some of the things that Tuscarores were doing at Prospect and different places had an impact on the movement generally?
Well, I'm not really qualified to speak a lot about the AIM movement nationwide. Mm-hmm.
But just speaking of, you know, here, sort of.
Well, in the county, I remember at about the same time that I was appointed to the House of Representatives, a guy by the name of Howard Brooks was forming a Tuscarora movement, and he had a lot of people scared. Now, that could have been one of the factors that, after that, it seemed like there was some people were more willing to sit down and let's sit down and talk. It might have led to that, the compromise that I mentioned to you where the legislation was passed adding more minorities to the Board of Education. Mm-hmm. That could have been a result of some of that activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In what way do you think? I mean, I remember Howard Brooks went up to Raleigh. I think I remember reading about that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think they went up to Raleigh and they sort of camped out at the Commission of Indian Affairs. And well, I think it got some people to thinking that, you know, we better, maybe we better do something here to sort of give these Indians some of what they're wanting. But I think it may have had that effect to some degree. Not a lot, but to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's any way it slowed down the process or made your work more difficult? Or?
No, I can't say that. I can't say that it did that. I think what one of the things that started happening in the 70s was that there were some white citizens of the county that decided, you know, if we don't step forward, you know, this county could just go south in a hurry. Mm-hmm. And we need to step up and some people, there were some good white people that was involved in things in the 70s, and you know, that needs to be noted. Mm-hmm. And I think there was probably some more that, you know, that were doing some things behind the scenes, maybe that was beneficial to in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Are any of those folks still living that you feel like I should talk to?
Well, right off, I can't think of anybody. Of course, I know you're going to talk to Bob Mangum. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to talk to Bob. Bob's been involved a long time, and right off, I can't think of anybody. One person comes to my mind was Mayor Muscle White in Lumberton. He was a good man, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. He was the mayor probably from about 72 to 76 and 77. And, I think he was a friend of Indian people, and we had a lot of friends in the white race. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. I think that does it, unless you feel like you have something else you want to add that we've left left out.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, you've covered it very completely.
Well, I may have not. I probably.